Not Guilty, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. An undocumented immigrant is found not guilty of murder in San Francisco. His case had become a rallying cry for opponents of immigration.
This verdict does not build any bridges. It shows due process, but it doesn't build bridges. It's a polarizing case.
Plus, Hondurans are tired of waiting for election results.
People will keep putting on pressure. It's picking up and getting more and more intense every single day.
And a coastal city in Florida wrestles with a global problem, climate change.
It's lovely here. What a great place to live. Except when you get a storm surge of 10 feet, 12 feet, your first floor is going to be almost entirely underwater.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Wow, so much going on this Friday. The tax bill in Congress, not to mention former Trump advisor Michael Flynn pleading guilty of lying to the FBI about Russia. But we start today with a different story, one that's had a massive impact on our nation's immigration debate. I'm talking about the case involving Jose Inez Garcia Zarate. He's the undocumented immigrant from Mexico who was on trial for murder for the shooting death of Catherine Steinle in San Francisco back in 2015. Candidate Trump often cited this case to support his call for a crackdown on immigration. Yesterday, Garcia Zarate was acquitted on the most serious charges against him, murder and manslaughter. Here's the victim's father, Jim Steinle, speaking before the verdict in the case was announced.
We somehow or another amazingly got caught up in immigration and Trump. And we have our views on immigration, we have our views on Trump, but this was the death of my daughter.
So hard to even imagine how terrible all this has been for the Steinle family. The World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, joins me now from the Bay Area. She's been covering this case for us from the beginning. What happened that day on July 1st, 2015, when Kate Steinle was killed, Monica?
Well, it was a sunny day in San Francisco, and she was walking with her father along one of the piers here, and she was shot and killed. The man with the gun, his name was Jose Inez Garcia Zarate, who's 45 years old, and the case went on from there.
So why did this case get so much national attention?
Well, the case got a lot of national attention because he had been deported many times, and he also had a series of low-level offenses, all nonviolent felonies involving small possessions of drugs. So he had been in contact with law enforcement several times and been released. And it blew up because he was an immigrant, an undocumented immigrant, tied to a murder. And there were a lot of people who thought, including Trump, who was a budding presidential candidate at the time, who thought this man should never have been in the country in the first place.
This woman, Catherine Steinle, was killed in 2015. Here we are in 2017. How did we get to where we are now with Garcia Zarate being found not guilty for murder?
What we saw was that the judicial process played out. The court case took a while. And in the end, he was convicted of being a felon in possession of a firearm. And that was far less than what the prosecution wanted. But over 5 weeks, a 12-person jury was not convinced that Garcia Zarate intended to kill Kate Steinle. There were doubts. Was it accidental? And with those doubts, they couldn't deliver that first-degree, you know, murder conviction.
President Trump tweeted out after this verdict, the Kate Steinle killer came back and back over the weakly protected Obama border, always committing crimes and being violent, and yet this info was not used in court. His exoneration is a complete travesty of justice. Build the wall. How do you see things playing out as the immigration debate continues?
Well, if we were to take the heated political rhetoric aside, you would hear that there is a serious debate about the immigration system and its flaws and whether somebody with a record like Garcia Zarate should have been in the country with multiple deportations. I think there's a way to talk about whether that reflects sound immigration policy in the United States. What's happening is that any sort of nuanced view on immigration policy or whether sanctuary cities make sense is lost when you have it cast, including by Donald Trump, as he's a killer, he's an immigrant, and he shouldn't be here. When we know that when you look at the numbers of undocumented immigrants in the United States, you'll see that somebody like Garcia Zarate is an anomaly. that most people in the country without papers have not been deported so many times, that they don't have a long criminal record. And that reality is lost when so much attention is placed on a case like this. And it seems like the jury was thinking about this as well, because if they thought about his immigration record as part of their deliberations, it seems that the outcome might have been different. But they were looking at what are the facts of the case. And I feel like that it's getting mixed up. We're seeing somebody's immigration background mixed up with the cold facts of a criminal case.
The World's Monica Campbell, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
By the way, Jose Ines Garcia Zarate will likely serve jail time for his conviction of felony possession of a firearm, and it is expected he'll be deported after that sentence. Meantime, on the other side of the country in New York,
Ice Free NYC!
Public defenders protesting outside a Brooklyn courthouse this week. Don't know if you could hear it, but they're shouting, Ice Free NYC, ICE as in Immigration and Customs Enforcement. These attorneys are angry because ICE agents arrested an immigrant inside one of the city's courthouses, and it wasn't the first time. WNYC's Beth Fertig is following the story. So what happened to trigger such a public outcry by public defenders in New York, Beth?
So there was an immigrant named Genaro Rojas Hernandez who had a court appearance this week because he was charged with punching a woman and violating a restraining order. And he was sitting outside in the hallway when the judge got word that ICE was in the building and that they wanted to detain him. So she told his lawyer from Legal Aid, who went outside to talk to him about his rights. And the Legal Aid folks say she was prevented from talking to him in private because the ICE agents were already detaining him. They somehow blocked her from having access to him. But whatever the case, his lawyer went back into the courtroom. She told the judge, hey, I want to talk to my client. She was allowed to speak to him. His hearing resumed. The ICE agents then took him into their custody, and they're seeking to deport him. But as soon as this happened, word spread like wildfire among all the public defenders in the building, and they said ICE is here. It went up on Twitter. That protest sound that you heard came from a Twitter feed, and they marched outside, and they had this protest.
So were immigration agents from ICE breaking policy by entering this courthouse?
No, they were not. Courts are public buildings. Anyone can enter them. And the Office of Court Administration says ICE followed its own procedures by notifying the court officers that they were there in the building. But the legal aid lawyers believe ICE took the client into some kind of restricted space behind the courtroom, and it was hard to talk to the man. And this is why the Immigrant Defense Project here in New York has been meeting with the state's top judge, urging her to make some rules about where ICE can and cannot go.
Why do you think this particular case caused so much outrage with the public defenders? Because isn't Mr. Rojas Hernandez, is he charged with domestic abuse?
Yeah, he is. And an immigrant who's charged with a crime is considered deportable, and an undocumented immigrant is considered deportable. He fit both categories. But I think the outrage is just over the principle of having ICE in these courthouses, because to the lawyers, they are considered sensitive locations. They believe that it's going to have a chilling effect. And they, in surveys, the public defenders have said their clients have been more fearful about going to their court appearances because they fear ICE will pick them up. Although we've asked court administration for data, there's no evidence, no hard data suggesting that people are not showing up to court appearances. But, you know, this is very anecdotal right now. And even prosecutors are saying it's hard to get immigrants to cooperate, or harder than it used to be.
So these were public defenders who were protesting. Are there any attorneys who are not public defenders who are pushing back?
There seems to be pretty universal consensus among the bar in New York that this is just a bad idea. The Brooklyn district attorney, after this happened this week, Eric Gonzalez, he said it has an impact on due process. He doesn't want ICE in the courts. And it's a really tough thing to deal with, because ICE is saying that they need to pick people up in courts precisely because you have so-called sanctuary cities like New York, where the local police do not detain a person that ICE wants unless that person is accused or charged, actually convicted even, of a serious crime. And so ICE says, you know, every week they send out publicity emails to reporters saying, look at all these people we had to pick up because sanctuary cities didn't hold them in their jails, and courts are safe locations where our agents can go. We know somebody's going to have a court appearance. We can get them there. So if the police and the jails don't hold on to them, then we're going to show up at the courts. But, you know, as I said, there this rising alarm about the effect that this can have. And in New York, the court administration has documented at least 40 cases of this happening in the city courts this year. And there's going to be more meetings. The Immigrant Defense Project is planning more protests in the coming weeks. They want to meet with the state's chief judge. So this is not going away.
Beth Furtig at WNYC in New York. Thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Okay, so this A-side, B-side is a little bit more complicated, but just bear with me.
That's the world's Brandy Fullwood, who's in the studio with me for this week's A-side, B-side. What are we hearing here, Brandy?
This Icelandic lullaby from the Smithsonian Archives. The literal connection to the B-side is that both of the artists are from Iceland, but I kind of connected them a little bit more because of the emotional state that you hear when you listen to the music.
What emotional state is this?
I don't really have a word for it. It's kind of like, I'm trying to compare it to the initial pain of heartbreak and like kind of the time before anyone actually believes that you're fine. Like, I don't know. Do you even remember like your first heartbreak or like the most like devastating one?
You're putting me on the spot here. I do, very clearly. Fourth grade. My first crush, and I didn't even know what a crush was, so I didn't know what I was feeling. But it was a feeling deep in my heart that I liked this girl. Her name was Mandy. I really liked her. I just didn't know how to say it. So it was kind of like heartbreak from the get-go.
Yeah, so it's like the period after that where you're kind of sitting with the intentions of that person and really like reveling in their likeness and something that's positive about them and no longer feeling the pain of that anymore. Like you're convincing yourself that you're okay.
It's kind of remarkable. This is a chorus of like at least 20 people probably singing a lullaby. I mean, how calm can I feel as I'm going to bed hearing this?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely like the moment of just before the lullaby convinces you that you want to go to sleep. Like anyone can sing you a lullaby, but you kind of have to like work with the music to be like, okay, I'm ready to go to bed, or okay, I'm ready to move on.
So what's your B-side?
The B-side for me came together as Björk's full album Utopia, but I picked out Blissing Me, which we'll hear right now.
This is her latest album.
Yes.
My mouth was kissing now into the air. I am missing this is access.
And what do you hear just musically that kind of joins these two songs?
I think the thing that's really interesting about both of the tracks and the album is that the vocals and the musical arrangements are really elongated. They're like, this is going to be a long time. This is a long idea, and this is a long sentiment.
And I don't know how to put this into words, but they both feel totally Icelandic.
Exactly. And it's, you know, Iceland's 99th birthday, so what could be better than Björk and Icelandic lullabies?
Love Unrequited from fourth grade, music promised and delivered from the world's Brandy Fullwood. A-side, B-side is part of our future folk collaboration with the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. Brandy, thanks for this.
Thanks.
One Florida town's battle against rising sea levels. That's up next here on The World. I'm Marco Wertman. You're with The World. Florida took a couple of direct hits from Hurricane Irma back in September. Other than that, though, Floridians were spared the worst of this year's unprecedented Atlantic storm season. But the state still faces a serious threat from rising seas and stronger storms as our planet warms up. And much of Florida has yet to really wake up to that threat. But at least one small town is taking it very seriously. From our Livable Planet desk, here's Deepa Fernandez.
Hey, look at this. How? Look, look.
Big manatee.
Lynn Bauer and Harold Wanless are standing on the edge of a lagoon in the city of Satellite Beach, just south of Cape Canaveral. And they've caught sight of a manatee bobbing just under the dock where they're standing.
Isn't he beautiful? Hi there.
A sea turtle swims by and nudges the manatee. Then another turtle paddles by.
Yeah, they hang out together.
Bauer and Wanless are visitors to Satellite Beach, but they can't help imagining what it would be like to live in a place this magical.
You know, I look out here and it just seems so idyllic. It seems...
It is. It's lovely here. What a great place to live. Except
not all is as idyllic here as it seems.
You have to understand that when you get a storm surge of 10 feet, 12 feet, your first floor is going to be almost entirely underwater. You have to understand that king tides and heavy rainfalls are going to flood your areas.
You see, Satellite Beach, like most of Florida's east coast, is a barrier island, basically just a long, low sand dune barely above sea level. And as climate change pushes sea levels up and adds more punch to storms, places like this are extremely vulnerable to flooding. And it's not just some future threat.
We're here at Shell Street, which is one of our beach parks, and it's what we probably consider the highest eroding area of Brevard County, actually.
Courtney Barker is the city manager of Satellite Beach. She also grew up in the area. We step out onto a walkway leading to the shoreline. To the left and right, homes are perched precariously on the dunes.
We've already had a house that's lost its pool. Its deck is now teetering on the edge, and the rest of the homes are on the edge.
Climate change is already here in Satellite Beach, and the local government is trying to stay ahead of it. They're shoring up some areas with imported sand and have begun trying to buy up other threatened properties and turn them into parks. They're also raising some roads to deal with flooding. Barker drives me back over to the lagoon side of the island, away from the sea. It's basically downtown. We stop at the fire station. City Hall is across the street.
This intersection has the post office, our community center.
She points down the road towards the town's high school, middle school, and elementary school.
As well as two churches.
And not long ago, part of this area was underwater.
We had a rain event about a week after Irma, and we had to actually tow people out of the area.
The Public Works Department, the Police Department, both are flooded multiple times this year. This very area is projected to be sitting in water by 2050. So under Barker's leadership, Satellite Beach commissioned a block-by-block study of the city, and they're using it to develop a plan to respond to rising water.
Planning is so less expensive than reacting. You're talking $100,000 to plan and millions of dollars to react.
That includes buying property to move critical infrastructure like the fire station, putting in bigger pipes to drain away floodwaters, raising roads and restoring dunes. All important stuff, but a tiny city like Satellite Beach can only do so much on its own.
In or after Irma, we had 2 million gallons of raw sewage dumped into the lagoon because the high water table infiltrated water in and it overwhelmed the system.
John Fergus is a retired military veteran who's been active in city efforts.
The county owns that. We don't own it. Florida Power and Light owns the substation. Florida Department of Transportation owns A1A that's near the beach and State Road 513.
Okay, you get the picture. Satellite Beach doesn't control key parts of its infrastructure. And in the county, it's the only city planning for climate change. When I called Brevard County itself to interview someone about planning for flooding or erosion, I was repeatedly told that was the domain of emergency responders. No planning, just funds to respond. Harold Wanless, who I met by the lagoon with the Mantees, is not surprised. He may be a visitor here, but he knows the lay of the land and the water. He's chair of the geology department at the University of Miami and a leading expert on climate change, sea level rise, and barrier islands.
Who needs to kind of be at the head of this?
You know, the way it's turning out, it looks like it's the city governments and the town councils that are going to have to take charge. We have a total denial in our current governor.
Wanless is talking about Republican Rick Scott. It's been widely reported that under his leadership, state officials have even been told not to use the words climate change or global warming in official communications. Scott's officer said no such policy exists and didn't return a call for this story. But denial of the problem is widespread in Florida. In the absence of leadership from the top, Wanless applauds the efforts of Satellite Beach to prepare for higher water. Yet, he can't help but wonder if it's all just postponing the inevitable.
Wouldn't it be cheaper, you know, to help people move on rather than having to try to reestablish an infrastructure in a place that's now too vulnerable, too low to make it really work? You know, you could use that money to help people relocate.
Then Wanless gazes back out at the beauty of the lagoon, entranced. He knows there's no easy solution here. How do you ask people to let go of the place they live in and love? But the question is always lurking in the background here.
Ultimately, in the latter half of this century, there will have to be some sort of organized or disorganized retreat off of these low-lying areas and onto higher ground.
That's Randall Parkinson at Florida International University's Sea Level Research Center, who did the sea level rise study for the city.
And how that has worked out right now, nobody knows, but they are beginning to talk about it at least.
For The World, Deepa Fernandez, Satellite Beach, Florida.
Before the break, I want to tell you about something coming up next week on The World, China and sexual harassment. When the Harvey Weinstein scandal broke here in the U.S., it became international news, and it got people all over the globe talking about sexual harassment, including in China. One reaction there was a commentary in the state-run China Daily. It said China doesn't have sexual harassment because China's traditional values and conservative attitudes protect women against, quote, inappropriate behavior. Here's how one woman in Beijing reacted.
You know, I can't believe somebody wrote something like that in China Daily and arguing that there's no sexual harassment in China. I personally had this kind of experience, and I knew some of my friends had that kind of experience. So I was really shocked.
Yajun Zhang co-hosts a podcast about life in China, and she says women there are talking about sexual harassment now and rejecting the idea that it doesn't happen there.
People have a very strong reaction to it. You know, we don't have the Me Too campaign in China, but some people I remember wrote in saying that this guy is talking BS.
We'll hear more on those conversations in China about sexual harassment next week on the show. I'm Marco Werman. Saudi authorities recently rounded up a bunch of royal family insiders, even princes, and essentially jailed them at a five-star hotel.
Just imagine, I mean, anyone listening, you're a powerful person. You basically can call the shots, and all of a sudden, all that you can call now is room service.
Doing time at the Ritz-Carlton Riyadh, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Here's a number for you. The United Nations says 136 million people around the globe will need aid this coming year. Among them, Syrians displaced by 6 years of war, Rohingya Muslims struggling to survive in refugee camps in Bangladesh, and people from Yemen coping with a famine and a cholera outbreak in the middle of a civil war. Today in Geneva, the head of the UN's humanitarian operation, Mark Lowcock, put a dollar amount on the world's human needs.
The cost of our programs that we're proposing this year is $22.5 billion.
The UN is asking the world's nations, including the US, to cough up the money. The woman in New York City we're about to hear from, she's doing her part to relieve suffering in Yemen. Her name is Summer Nasser, and we first met her when she was in Yemen visiting her extended family. That was 2 years ago.
It's about 5:30. There's jets over us. As you can hear, the anti-aircraft missiles and gun shootings. From what I know, they're hitting the airport.
Summer Nasser joins us now. You're back in New York now. You've started up a charity that helps people in Yemen. What is your pitch? What do you tell prospective donors?
Yeah, so we're an organization by Yemenis for Yemenis. And so that's really important due to logistics and cultural sensitivity. All our staff, for example, and volunteers are not paid. And we believe that all effort should be towards aid at this moment, especially since the crisis has skyrocketed.
And what's reaction like? I mean, for one of the most severe humanitarian crises we're facing in the world today, I mean, do you feel like the public is reacting accordingly?
Absolutely not. The world does not know about what's going on in Yemen, at least on a humanitarian level, after 3 years of continuous war.
How bad is it on the ground in Yemen now? Like, how little food is there?
About 19 million people have no food. We're talking about two-thirds of the country. We also have a lot of issues in terms of no income, so no salaries, no food, diseases, and these things just get worse and worse over time. It's pretty bad. I mean, a lot of people don't know what to do. There's a lot of suicides now because they just can't handle it anymore. So that just shows you how bad it is.
How about your own family?
Well, I mean, half of my family is actually in the United States since the 60s, but I do have my other half who are actually in Aden right now and in Sana'a, and we're helping them. I mean, that's our responsibility. That's our duty towards our family. So they're okay, but still, the concern is not money. It's what's the solution to all of this war. Diseases are one of my concerns. I had my father who recently came back after a six-month visit, and he actually was taken in the hospital and diagnosed with cholera. And so you would think that we're privileged enough, you know, to avoid these situations, but unfortunately it's reaching everyone.
That's extraordinary. So yeah. How's he doing? Is he still in hospital in the States?
Oh, no, thank God. No, he's he actually healed in Aden and actually came back about a week ago. Gotcha. So he's back here, yeah.
So you were telling my producer earlier that Yemeni Americans are not really big on organized charities, but Yemeni Americans do support family back home. Explain that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yemeni Americans here in the community are more traditional based. So what they would do is that they would send via Western Union to or MoneyGram towards their families and locals that they know.
Wow, Western Union, old school.
Yeah, very old school. Very old school. But we're trying to revolutionize that in a way where a lot of money and effort exerts towards institutional organization that at the end of the day can have a bigger impact to villages across Yemen.
Summer, when you think about Yemen and your visits there as a girl, give us the memory or image that you kind of conjure up to counter the things we're seeing today.
It brings back really painful memories because what we used to be and what we are now is a total 360. I mean, as a child, I used to go out every day, literally walk around the streets feeling safe and feeling peaceful. And now it's everybody's worried about even leaving their homes. What if a random, you know, bomb goes off, or what if a random gunfight happens? And so they're really worried. They don't know what the future holds. And so it's a burden on us here who are very safe to try to find a solution for them, which is very, very much complicated right now.
Summer Nasser, thanks very much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you.
Summer Nasser started the program called Yemen Aid. It's one of the groups we highlight at PRI.org. We go next to the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. It's probably not what comes to mind when you think detention center, but that's exactly what the five-star luxury hotel has been turned into these past few weeks. It all started in early November when Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman rounded up some of the kingdom's most prominent figures and locked them inside the hotel. The prince called it a crackdown on corruption. My BBC colleague Lise Doucette was the first journalist allowed inside the Ritz since the arrests. I asked her how many people were being held there when she and her team paid that visit.
At the moment that we went in, we were told that it was 201. And this is 201 of the biggest of billionaires, at least 11 princes, at least four former government ministers. But that seven among the elite had been able to literally walk free because they had been able to challenge what's called the evidence against them. But then since we left the Ritz-Carlton, we heard of at least one very high profile guest, if you'd like to say, or detainee, prisoner even. even, who is Miteb bin Abdullah, regarded before as a possible contender to the throne, but now one of the people who was caught in this dragnet and is now a free man, but less richer, I think, because he handed over a certain amount of money as part of this, they call it a friendly process, not a formal investigation yet.
I mean, it's been described as an anti-corruption campaign. Your sense, is that what it is? Or is it some kind of PR move by Prince Mohammed bin Salman?
Well, what we found out by going inside was that there certainly is an anti-corruption process, if you like. In the last 2 years, we were told, very secretly, evidence was collected, bank statements, financial documents. Because when I said, well, why these people and not others? Because it did lead to accusations that this was not about corruption. This was about a power grab. That I was told that everyone who was in there has evidence against them, and they have to look at the evidence with their lawyers and decide whether or not they accept that the evidence is true. If not, they can go to court. I was told both in the hotel as well as by senior people outside that 4% of the people in there had said, I don't accept your evidence. We're going to court. My lawyer and I are going to take you to court. But that 95% of those people who were understandably furious and humiliated by being taken in under these sort of circumstances had said that they would pay up in order literally to buy their freedom. So when we got there, we were told that most people were just staying in their rooms, spending time with their lawyers, focusing on their case to try to get out of there as soon as possible.
Did you have a chance to speak with any of these detainees?
We asked to speak to some of the most high-profile ones. The answer came back that they didn't want to see us. They went up to one room and they said, someone will see you. But you can imagine, Margot, it's awkward. You walk into someone's room and it looks like a five-star luxury hotel room
because
anywhere.
Because it is.
Yes. And here's a guy sitting and, you know, he's wearing a casual white shirt. He's sitting next to the television. He's watching Premier League football. He looks very relaxed. And everyone around me, and there's about half a dozen people around me, they control his fate. So I know and he knows that anything he says will incriminate him. So we talked a bit. I said, how is everything? Are your conditions okay? Yes, my conditions are fine. Is your family coming to visit you? He said, no, my family, I don't want my family to visit me here. But he said that he was mainly spending time with his lawyer to focus on his case so that he could get this resolved as soon as possible.
Are they locked in their rooms? I mean, can they wander around the hotel? I mean, what was being in that hotel like? What did it look like?
Well, if you walk into any five-star hotel at what was, let's say, just was about a half an hour or so after midnight in Riyadh, most five-star hotels will still have people drinking coffee. So there were still people drinking in the lobby, but they were speaking in hushed conversations. They didn't raise their eyes. People tend to stay in their rooms because it's a damage limitation exercise. They don't want to run into other people. And I was told even the people who visit, whether it's family members, lawyers, and they also speak to members of their company. Don't forget, some of the people inside are running mega business empires. And so they're allowed to keep those companies running. So they're on the phone or they can have visits from these people. They tend to come and go through back doors. The whole thing is about discretion, limiting exposure, and getting out of there as soon as possible.
How long will they be detained in this Ritz-Carlton?
Well, a lot of people outside the hotel said that the Crown Prince better wrap this up as soon as possible because the longer it goes on, the more questions get asked. And the questions are swirling around Riyadh. I'll just give you a taste of it. Every young Saudi, and even not young Saudi that I spoke to, welcomed this crackdown on corruption. Saudi Arabia is known for its rampant corruption. At least four people from very different walks of life said to me that bribery had stopped, that nobody was asking for any money, no one was hinting any money,
wow.
That their documents were moving through ministers more quickly now because everyone thinks, oh my goodness, this is a crackdown on corruption. You know, I don't want to do anything which could get me, you know, ensnared by this dragnet. But there were also people who said, oh my goodness, we're getting reports that people are having heart attacks, that there's torture inside, that there's abuse during the interrogations. And whether or not we were finally given permission to go in because to try to counter some of those rumors, we didn't hear about reports of abuse from inside. Obviously, we got a very partial point of view. It's impossible under those circumstances to hear the full story. But we were told there was a medical center, doctors and nurses on standby. There was an admission, yes, there had been some illnesses. Diabetes was mentioned, heart, because a lot of people, we were told, were old. But just imagine, I mean, anyone listening, you're a powerful person. You basically can call the shots. And all of a sudden, all that you can call now is room service or call on a hotline because your power has been taken away from you. So there must be some stress and anger and altercations. And the people we spoke to, the officials who said we couldn't quote them by name, they hope that everyone will have checked out by the Ritz-Carlton by the end of December or early January.
Wild stories from Saudi Arabia. My BBC colleague, Lise Doucette, just back from a reporting trip to the Ritz-Carlton in Riyadh. Lise, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco. Always good to talk to you.
One candidate is a TV host. The other is the country's incumbent president. And both are declaring victory. Several days after Honduras held its presidential election, no surprise that things are tense there. Early on, opposition candidate Salvador Nasrallah, the TV host, was reported to have a 5-point lead. Then incumbent President Juan Orlando Hernandez appeared to be gaining. That led to protests, but still no official results. Those are now expected sometime tonight. Karen Spring has been following this situation closely. She's with the Honduras Solidarity Network. That's a group of 30 American and Canadian human rights organizations.
I know on the north coast of Honduras, there are protests and there are toll roads that are currently being burned to the ground. Normally, the protests and the looting and the roadblocks begin around midday, but then they really pick up in the evening. Last night, I went to 6 different areas around Tegucigalpa, the capital city, and the energy is amazing. People are very vibrant and they're very ready to keep doing what they're doing, as in taking roads, burning tires, and sort of creating chaos, but intentionally to sort of send a message to the Supreme Electoral Tribunal that they need to announce the results. And also to the international community that people are not going to accept fraud. And they're very aware that there's funny business going on inside the electoral tribunal, and they will not accept it.
We know the incumbent president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, came to power after a coup in 2009, and he's worked with the U.S. to crack down on drug trafficking. Just tell us a little more about him and the other candidate, Salvador Nasrallah.
Juan Orlando Hernandez, a lot of people in Honduras say that he's been ruling the country for 8 years, mostly because of his very prominent position in the Congress before he was actually president. And he's known to be a very strong U.S. ally in the region. And Salvador Nasrallah was elected as the leader of the Alliance Against the Dictatorship, or the Opposition Alliance. He actually doesn't have a history of being involved in the social movement, but he's a very well-known TV star in the country. And so he sort of gained popularity from his alliance with the former president, Manuel Zelaya, who was overthrown in 2009 to basically run against the current government of Juan Orlando Hernandez in these elections. Definitely, you can say that Nasrallah has a much more progressive agenda in relation to Juan Orlando. And that's sort of why many people in Honduras believe that a lot of the international institutions and the U.S. and Canadian government are much more in favor of Juan Orlando Hernandez because of his economic agenda that's much more in line with the policies of North American governments.
So let's talk about the suspicion of fraud in the recent election for a moment. Your organization, the Honduras Solidarity Network, actually organized human rights delegations to observe voting on Election Day. What did you see?
So we actually did a huge 170 observers in 2013. And so these elections in 2017 have been very similar. We saw vote buying, violence outside and around the polling stations, people being intimidated, random closures of polling stations, and a heavy presence of military all over the country in the days leading up to the elections.
If the final tally sends the election to Hernandez, the incumbent, will protests continue, do you think?
Yes, and we're actually very worried about that because last night was a very violent night, military firing, live rounds. There were 10 people in the capital city that were admitted into the hospital for injuries. 7 of those people were injured with bullet wounds. So I think the general mood and the general sort of feeling of Hondurans is that they've lost all faith and trust that the electoral tribunal are actually doing their job in a democratic and fair way. And they're remembering what happened in 2009 after the military coup. And so when you go and you talk to people that are blocking the roads and that are protesting, they're saying, we're here defending our votes. we are the electoral tribunal now, and we want Salvador Nasralla's victory to be recognized. And so we're deeply worried that the situation is going to get more violent as more people take to the streets and refuse to accept the results that the tribunal announces, particularly if it's in favor of Juan Orlando Hernandez.
Karen Spring, the country coordinator for the Honduras Solidarity Network, a group of 30 American and Canadian human rights organizations. Thanks very much for the update.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on the first day of the last month of the year.
Get 50% off everything at oldnavy.com. Extended through Tuesday. Kohl's. Give joy. Get joy. Hurry and save 15% on select items with coupon. JCPenney.
Ah, yes, tis the season to be busting out your credit card. But before you do that, you might want to know about some stories we've got coming up next week about the women who make your clothes. We're calling this one Wear and Tear. Jasmine Garz is with our Women's Lives desk. Jazz, what are we going to hear in Wear and Tear?
Yeah, Marco, we're going to talk about the garment industry, both here and overseas. And we're going to start with the story of what it was like when most clothes were made here by mill girls. And we're going to meet someone named Akri Bell Lassiter. I met her in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina. She started working at a textile mill just at the end of World War II. And she's going to talk about how that changed her life.
My daddy was a sharecropper. He never gave us girls any money, but he would give the boys money. And I couldn't go to college, couldn't do anything but go to work.
You know, Lassiter's story is a story of success, but what ultimately ends up happening is that the garment industry mostly leaves the U.S. And in Lassiter's town, it went abroad mostly to China, to Bangladesh. And that's where we're going, to Bangladesh.
You also want for this series Wear and Tear, you want everybody to share what they're wearing.
Yeah, Marco, we're asking people to flip their tag and take a picture. Tweet a photo of your clothing label using the hashtag #FlipYourTag. And we are going to send you info, like how much do workers in that country where your shirt is make? And what is the environmental impact of the fabric it's made of? Tell us what's on your label. Flip your tag.
That's some real news you can use, everyone, when you're gift buying this month. We're at PRI The World, hashtag flip your tag. So check out Wear and Tear. Our first story airs on Monday. Finally today, a new book about Josephine Baker's epic life. It's a comic book biography of the African-American performer from her childhood in St. Louis to her life as a superstar in France. Adeline Sia spoke with the authors in Paris.
J'ai deux amours.
In this song, written for Josephine Baker, she sings, "I have two loves, my country and Paris." Author José-Louis Bocquet says when she debuted in Paris in 1925 in an all-black American review, the 19-year-old dancer became an overnight sensation.
Pour cette fameuse soirée de 1925,
on that famed 1925 evening, she shattered notions of what a black artist was. That night, she crystallized a kind of fusion between jazz, cubism, orientalism, and the 1920s passion for African art.
That's what she represented in France.
Mon pays est Paris.
Baker was a comedic performer, and her exotic appeal helped her become the first black superstar. To this day, she's best remembered as the woman who danced topless with a skirt of dangling bananas. Paris-based artists like Ernest Hemingway, Man Ray, and Picasso fell for her as she danced the Charleston. This made Josephine Baker an appealing subject for Bouquet and his wife, graphic artist Catel Muller. But it was Baker's son who got them started on the project. Jean-Claude Bouillon Baker is one of Baker's 12 children. She adopted them from all over the world with her fourth husband. Bouillon Baker says he always thought his mother's extraordinary story deserved a different kind of biography. I thought I should find an alternative kind of media, he said, to attract a large number of readers, especially young ones who wouldn't know her. The result is a black-and-white graphic book of almost 600 pages filled with compelling scenes and characters from the Roaring Twenties, stylish costumes and cars, and fine architectural details from all around the globe. Katel Müller says the biggest challenge in creating a comic based on a real person was crafting a face that's authentic and that would age over 7 decades. Also, Baker's son wanted a say in how his mother would look in the book.
Et ça, ça a été vraiment difficile parce que j'ai fait beaucoup d'essais avant où ils me disent non, c'est pas elle.
It wasn't easy, she said, because I tried a lot of different sketches and he'd say, no, it's not her. She was thinner or rounder, more this, more that. I worked on it until I found my character and finally he said, it's her. Up in her artist's studio, Müller has rows of sketchbooks that she filled when she and Bouquet traveled to the places where Josephine Baker lived or worked to capture the backdrop of Baker's colorful life. Müller says in St. Louis, Josephine Baker dreamed of being a princess in a castle.
Elle a grandi dans une ville où à chaque place il y a une statue de Saint Louis. Donc déjà ça nous
éveille. She grew up in a city where there's a statue of the French king known as St. Louis in each square, she says. The French arrived there in the 18th century and built large stone mansions for the wealthy. And when Josephine Baker was young, she worked for these people, and she must have thought that one day she'd have a house that would look like a castle. Baker did end up living in a few castles, including a 15th century estate in southwest France. The book depicts her happy family life there and her bravery during World War II as part of the French resistance. But there was another moment in Baker's life the authors wanted to highlight, when Baker took part in the 1963 March on Washington.
I'm glad to see this day come to pass.
At a time when segregation was the law in some American states, Baker had the same rights as any citizen in France. She made a special trip to address a crowd of more than 200,000 on the National Mall.
I want you to know also how proud I am to be here today. And after so many long years of struggle, fighting here and elsewhere, for your rights are rights, the rights of humanity, the rights of man, I'm glad that you have accepted me to come.
Author Bouquet says that part of Baker's life was dismissed as a small detail in many other books about her.
Dans la plus fameuse biographie publiée aux États-Unis sur Josephine Baker,
the best-known biography only dedicates 1.5 lines to her trip to Washington, even though that was an essential part of her life. She stood alongside Martin Luther King, an icon of the 20th century. She's in the same photograph.
Baker's son Jean-Claude says he couldn't be more pleased with the scope and look of his mother's comic book biography. He says most of all, what jumps off the page is his mother's boundless energy. In the book, she seems to be springing from one bubble to the other, he says. She moved at 200 miles an hour all the time. For The World, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
You know, I can't help thinking that some of you were there at the March on Washington in 63. Do you remember seeing Josephine Baker that day? Seriously, if you were there and saw her, tell us, please, what you thought. We're at PRI The World on both Twitter and Facebook. That's our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you on Monday.
PRI, Public Radio International.